From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. After months of diplomatic effort by Britain, France, and Germany to stop its move toward nuclear weapons, Iran confirmed this weekend that it has resumed building centrifuges key to enriching uranium for the bomb. Tehran insists its nuclear program is peaceful. Fewer and fewer observers believe that. Washington doesn't. The International Atomic Energy Agency is broadcasting doubts. Our guest tonight, David Kaye, who was famously skeptical about Iraq's alleged WMD program, says he believes Iran could be nuclear-armed in 12 months. Last year, Iran promised Europe to halt its suspect nuclear programs in exchange for trade incentives. That deal fell through, and the Middle East may be on the verge of an entirely new strategic profile. Iranian nuclear weapons in the world's oil patch, on Iraq's doorstep, in Israel's gun sights. Tonight on Point, tracking the footprints of an emerging nuclear power and a turning point in the Middle East. Scott Peterson covers Iran and the Middle East for the Christian Science Monitor. I asked him whether European diplomats are conceding failure in their nuclear negotiations with Iran.
Well, I think the Europeans are definitely losing patience with Iran. I think they were expecting a lot more from Iran in terms of openness regarding the IAEA's nuclear inspections in Tehran. Of course, the IAEA has been very tough on Iran and, in fact, gave a very strong rebuke several weeks ago to Iran, saying that basically Iran had not come clean with its program, that still questions remained, that there was still a lot of issues that just simply had not been dealt with in a clear enough manner for the international community to have any confidence that Iran's nuclear program really is for peaceful purposes and not for a weapons program. So I think the Europeans, the three foreign ministers of the Troika.
This is the France, Germany, the U.K.
Correct. They negotiated their Tehran agreement last October. The plan was that basically if Iran came clean on their weapons programs and cooperated with weapons inspectors, then the Europeans would provide expertise in terms of nuclear power and also would be able to make sure that Iran did not get too much more of a kind of a diplomatic backlash from the international community. Now, the Iranians don't believe that the Europeans have come through with any kind of help and that they've been overly critical. The Europeans, on the other hand, feel very, very miffed that the Iranians have not come through with their end of the bargain. And so at the moment, I think the Europeans are really swiftly losing patience.
It was just last week that the Europeans sat down with Iran again, said that they would continue talking. And then on Saturday, Iran confirmed reports that it had resumed building nuclear centrifuges. Washington says these are intended to enrich uranium for weapons-grade use in bombs. Do the Europeans doubt that?
Well, again, it comes down to a question of definitions. In this case, certainly those centrifuges that the Iranians have been working on, it's up to question about really what their purpose is. Certainly, if you were to have a peaceful nuclear power program and you were to have a self-contained uranium enrichment plan, then you would need to have these kind of centrifuges. This is one way to enrich uranium. Now, of course, in the process of creating that nuclear fuel for your power plants, you are also taking a very giant stride toward the kind of enrichment activities that you need to pursue also for nuclear weapons. And so, but this is where Washington and the Europeans divide their interpretations, because Washington, of course, making very clear that they are certain that Iran is pursuing nuclear weapons capability. They see all kinds of signals, and partly because Iran hasn't been as cooperative as they could have been by any stretch, but they have been seen even by the IAEA to have been hiding parts of their program. The U.S. side sees all of these things as pointing to the Iranians trying to hide something. The Europeans are much more forgiving on that front, not convinced that a lot of these things can't be explained away on the Iranian side by sheer bureaucracy, which for anyone who's spent any time in Iran understands that is possible, or it's not anyway beyond the pale. So really it's a question of intentions, but as you point out, this has very much put the Europeans in a tight spot, because it's very difficult for them now to argue or take the Iranian side, if you will, against the American assumptions about Iran's program.
Colin Powell saying in Kuwait on Saturday, it is our judgment that Iran is developing a nuclear weapon. And the International Atomic Energy Association, also very tough on this. In the last 18 months, their inspectors on site there say they've uncovered an escalating series of contradictions in Iranian statements and evidence that nuclear specialists consider strongly suggestive of a clandestine nuclear weapons program. That from the Washington Post. Colin Powell now saying, Scott Peterson, that this needs to go before the Security Council. If that were to happen, when would it be, and what would the significance be of taking the issue of Iran's nuclear program before the UN's High Council?
This is the one thing that the Iranians were hoping to avoid, because, of course, what this opens the road to is the possibility of some kind of sanctions by the UN Security Council against Iran. And this is what Iran was trying to forestall by negotiating this Tehran agreement last October. It's also something that the U.S. side has been pushing for well over a year now. This has always been the stick that's been dangled over Iran, and in fact, many argue, diplomats and other analysts argue, that both the Europeans and the U.S. side were very effective last October in kind of playing this good cop, bad cop diplomacy against Iran. In other words, on the U.S. side, there was a lot of drum beating, a lot of, you know, we want to take you to the U.N. Security Council and possibly threaten sanctions. We don't believe you. And then on the other hand, with that in the background, you had the European diplomats, three foreign ministers going to Tehran, basically appealing to, you know, kind of Iran's pride as a nation and saying, this is, you know, we're going to offer you a way out if you're serious. But with that beating in the background, I mean, the Iranians basically agreed to accept all of these different terms, which both European and American alike believe that without that drum beating on the U.S. side, probably the Iranians would not have given nearly so much diplomatically.
But of course, in the event they didn't give that much, they turned around and began developing the centrifuges anyway, it appears.
Well, precisely. And I think this is where Europeans now are also much more concerned. And I think you'll find more and more now who think that Iran really is going after some kind of weapons program. And even if they believe that, though, I think that the European perspective is one of coming from what we used to call during the apartheid era in South Africa, constructive engagement, where the Europeans believe that it is better to have Iran not necessarily sanctioned, but at least engaged with the international community on this issue, that perhaps it's inevitable that Iran will gain a nuclear weapon in time in the next few years or within a decade, that probably there's nothing the international community can do to stop that. And so it's better to actually at least have some kind of a framework of inspections in place, of the Iranians not feeling so isolated that everything is taking place kind of behind closed doors. And so I think that that's what they're calculating, is that is the, though it's not a good way to proceed, it's better than the alternative, which is completely shutting Iran off.
Scott Peterson, thanks so much for joining us.
With pleasure. Thank you.
Scott Peterson covers Iran and the Middle East for the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke with us from Moscow. We are talking tonight about Iran and the prospect of a new emerging nuclear power in the Middle East. Are you watching the slow-motion nuclear drama unfolding in Tehran? Is it already too late to stop the Iranian bomb? And can Washington deal simultaneously with Iraq and Iran? Will Israel intervene? And what happens if it does? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is David Kaye, weapons inspector for the Bush administration in Iraq until January 2004. He's a senior fellow at the Potomac Institute for Policy Studies. He served as UNSCOM, chief nuclear weapons inspector in Iraq after the Gulf War. Good evening and welcome back to On Point, David Kaye.
Happy to be with you tonight, Tom.
Great to have you. Also joining us from Washington tonight is Mohammad Hadi Samadi, political scientist at Tehran University and a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Good evening and welcome, Mohammad Hadi Samadi.
Good evening. My pleasure.
Thank you for joining us. David Kaye, you've spent a lot of time in your life looking at nuclear weapons programs, thinking about nuclear weapons inspection. Now you, like much of the rest of the inspection world, is looking on at Iran. What do you make of what's going on there? Do you see, is there any doubt at this point that there's nuclear weapons production underway or in the wings? How do you see it?
I don't think there's any evidence that it's underway. I see considerable evidence that the Iraqis are developing the capability and the foundations for a nuclear weapons program.
You mean to say the Iranians, I assume?
I'm sorry, the Iranians, having spent too much time
right,
next door.
Right.
The Iranians are developing the foundation for it, and a very solid foundation. What is not clear is whether they have made more than a principal decision to gain the capability and have actually made the decision to proceed with weapons acquisition. I think we have very opaque insights into the motivations and plans of that regime.
David Kaye, I understand you were talking with one of my producers today saying you believe that at this point Iran, if it decided to flip the switch, is 12 months away, if it decided to go that way, from having nuclear weapons.
The evidence that the IAEA has gathered is of a foundation that if you decided to go all out and to plunge ahead, you could have your first device within about 12 months.
And what does that evidence look like at this point? Is it better than the evidence we had of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq 2 years ago?
Well, that's the difference between the two. It's considerably better. You actually have evidence as opposed to a faith-based intelligence when you're dealing with Iran. And you have evidence gathered not by Americans, but by international inspectors, as well as a considerable amount of evidence given by the Iranians themselves as to what they've acquired and what they were building. So you have evidence of both low-enriched and high-enriched uranium that they have, in fact, enriched using centrifuges. You have evidence of plutonium separation. You have evidence of proceeding with a heavy water reactor, which would produce plutonium for a plutonium-based bomb. You have evidence of a large amount, about 18 tons of uranium imported and not under safeguards from China. So there's a lot of evidence around.
And one more point there, David Kaye. Why? Why exactly? How do you understand the Iranian political calculation, strategic calculation, that would lead leaders there to want to put it into position to have a nuclear weapon within that kind of time frame if they decided to? Why?
I think it may be different according to which political leaders you're talking about. The Iranian activities in the nuclear area go back over 50 years to the Shah's period, and there was considerable evidence under the Shah that the Shah had aspirations, feeling that Iran, a non-Arab state in the Middle East, non-Arab but Muslim, Shia, not Sunni, needed that for its own national interests and should not be denied it by any international agreement. I think there are others, particularly around the Revolutionary Guard, who look at the American presence in the Gulf, look at the Israelis with their possession of nuclear weapons, and think it's required for their own security interest, a much more pragmatic, user-oriented effort. The interesting thing is I find it very hard to find anyone in Iran, at least judging by their statements both internationally and domestically, who doesn't say Iran has the right to acquire. That seems to be very broadly based, regardless of your particular political orientation in Iran today.
Mohammad Hadi Samadi, let's turn to you. Recently from Tehran University, you live inside this bubble. How do you see it? Tehran denies that it is developing nuclear weapons capability. It says this is a peaceful nuclear program. Do you believe that?
Oh, I certainly, at this point, believe that they don't have a military component in their nuclear activities. But I think I agree with David Kaye that they are contemplating to establish themselves as a nuclear capability and technology-based that they could, if in the case they deemed it necessary, they could launch the last few miles and reach that capability. I think they haven't made a decision as of this point, in my judgment, to pursue a nuclear weapon, but they have definitely decided that they need a technological base.
And what about David Kaye's point that all voices out of Iran seem to insist on their right to develop a nuclear weapon despite the international nuclear nonproliferation agreements and that whole notion?
I think I agree with that fundamentally, that they, you know, the desire to develop nuclear capability is actually has become a sort of a national pride issue and crosses the political boundaries to a large degree. And it's actually the only issue that I would say the regime is not under any legitimacy question by the public. You could find the regime under tremendous pressure, domestic and other issues, but this is one of the few exceptions, actually, that cut across the divide internally.
We want to hear more about that, Mohammad Hadi Samadi and David Kaye, but please stand by. We have to take a short break. We are talking tonight about Iran going nuclear and the emerging A-bomb in the Middle East. You can join the conversation tonight. Iraq didn't have nukes. Iran may be about to. did the U.S. focus on the wrong end of the axis of evil? And with Iran apparently moving ahead, is non-proliferation now dead? Does every nation have a right to its own nuclear weapons? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Iran's apparent push for nuclear weapons and the strategic implications of a new emerging atomic power in the Middle East. You can join this conversation tonight. Can Iran be stopped from going nuclear? How? By whom? What if Israel does it? What's the fallout then? Or is it already too late? Is an Iranian nuclear bomb inevitable? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by political scientist from Tehran University, Mohammad Hadi Samadi. He's now a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington. And also from Washington tonight by David Kaye, weapons inspector in Iraq for the Bush administration until January 2004. In the early 90s, chief nuclear weapons inspector for UNSCOM in Iraq after the Gulf War. He joins us from the Potomac Institute for Policy Studies. Mohammad Hadi Samadi, what about the different factions in Iran? It's clear now you've got the hardline clerics and a group of would-be reformers and a lot of social political discontent. Are there sharp disagreements that you can perceive among the different political sectors in Iran about whether or not it's a good idea to move forward with this foundation for nuclear weapons development?
Oh, I don't see a sharp disagreements over the pursuit of nuclear capability. I think there are by and large, the majority of the political forces and the factions have somewhat more or less supported the pursuit of nuclear capability and nuclear technology. I think you could find disagreements in terms of approach to the international community and trust-building mechanisms and the sort of diplomacy that they pursue. But fundamentally, I think they see themselves, Iran, in general, Iranians see themselves entitled under the NPT agreements and their legal obligations to have a nuclear cycle capability. And I think there are large across-the-board support for that. And beside the diplomatic style and how to deal with the European Union or with the international community and IAEA, to give transparency and to give some sort of confidence and trust, I don't see a fundamental difference as far as the political factions are concerned.
We're at 1-800-423-8255. Alex is on the line from New Hampshire. Hi, Alex. You're on the air.
Hi. Just wanted to make some observations that I think is very critical. Last year, when the Iranian government began some sort of dialogue with the European Union, in particular Germany, France, and United Kingdom.
A very specific dialogue aimed at ending this, pulling them back from nuke development.
Well, that was the pretense. I believe the main goal was to procrastinate and try to get the United States off their back. They were very afraid, the Iranian leadership was very afraid that they were next in line after Iraq. They were horrified at such a quick crumbling of power apparatus in Iraq. And they are not very popular in their own country. Therefore, they felt that it probably would suit their even strategic interest to kowtow a bit.
So you see a kind of rope-a-dope strategy in their talks with Europe last year. Europe wanted to negotiate an end to this. They saw an American threat. Let me put it to David Kaye. And, Alex, thank you for your call. David Kaye, what about U.S. power then and now? Did Iran fear that Washington would keep right on coming? And what about today? Does the U.S. have the capacity to stop whatever's going on in Iran on the nuclear front?
Well, I think there may well have been last summer in June when the discussions took place, or actually they started in April, took place. There may well have been a fear that the U.S. would turn right, as the saying goes, and go to Tehran. I think that faded very quickly. I actually think the European strategy is one of recognizing that it is almost, not completely, but almost inevitable that Iran will acquire nuclear weapons at some point, and believing that stability will be obtained if that's a slow acquisition process as opposed to a sudden acquisition of nuclear weapons if they were to go for broke, and playing that off and hoping that I think the Europeans, at least I just come back from Europe, are really very pessimistic about their belief to get the Iranians to completely abandon their technology-based program.
And what about Washington at this point? Are they also quietly accepting Iran's nuclear armament as an inevitability?
Oh, I think there are those in this administration who see it as frightening as they saw Iraq, and perhaps more frightening because the evidence is more solid. On the other hand, I think there are many people in Washington who are pragmatic. And look, Iran is sitting on the world's sixth largest reserves of oil, and oil at $40 a barrel. They have the capacity to hurt us as well as us to hurt them. And if the pressure on the Iranians were to go up too fast, too hard, the Iranians have the possibility very easily of causing tremendous problems next door in Iraq that would make the possibility of a new regime being stable almost impossible. So I think Washington is not at all unhappy with the Europeans taking the lead, although they're very pessimistic that in fact, the Iranians will take the bait and move anywhere like they thought the Europeans thought the Iranians would do last summer.
And you seem to be saying that, in effect, Tehran has Washington over a barrel. It's tied up in Iraq. They know it can't afford to really turn its attentions on them, and that they could give Washington a lot of trouble, almost buying themselves a green light on nuclear weapons development.
Well, look, Iraq has caused us problems in many areas. It's undercut the credibility of our intelligence, and that's why you see Washington relying so heavily on the IAEA's findings and the Europeans' lead. It's made us vulnerable. If there was anyone who last year thought a right turn towards Tehran would be a good idea, they're being awfully quiet about it now that, in fact, Iraq, after a quick victory, turned out to be a long, unstable transformation process. So I don't think there's any appetite in the Bush administration for military action at this point. I think the Iranians realize that.
I want to welcome another voice into our conversation. Leonard Spector joins us from Washington. He is Deputy Director of the Monterey Institute of International Studies, Center for Nonproliferation Studies. Good evening and welcome, Leonard Spector.
Good evening.
I wish you'd outline for us the strategic scenario if and when Iran does push ahead, whether it's 12 months or longer, and develop a nuclear weapon. How does that change the strategic chessboard in the Middle East? What are the implications of an Iranian nuclear weapon on Iraq's doorstep, right there on top of the oil patch, within range of Israel? How does it play out if it happens?
Well, first of all, I think we have to consider the implications for nation-to-nation relations and how this changes a strategic balance. But we also need to look at a second dimension, which is the impact of potential terrorism. So let's do the nation-by-nation stuff first.
Okay.
I think if you sort of go around the region, some nations are ready and able to defend themselves through traditional deterrence means, and Israel is the key case. I suppose Pakistan, if there's any potential for conflict with Iran, is in a similar position. The Saudis and the Emirates are sort of protected by the American presence, as is Iraq.
And by traditional defense, you mean the capacity to go in with fighter jets, bomber jets, and attempt to take out nuclear facilities, as Israel did in Iraq?
No, what I meant basically is there'll be a nuclear standoff. Israel has a nuclear potential with missiles that can strike Iran and vice versa, and I think both countries will be cautioned by that in terms of saber-rattling or actual use as nations.
So the old Soviet-U.S.-style mutually assured destruction deterrent.
That's correct, and the Israelis are thought to have diesel submarines with cruise missiles that might be able to have a second strike potential, et cetera, against Iran.
Okay.
But the difficulty is we aren't only dealing with nations. The Iranians have these extensive links to terrorist organizations, and I think that is the transforming dimension of this whole discussion. Once they get high-enriched uranium in Iran, the stuff for nuclear weapons, we become extremely vulnerable because it's not only a question of what the Iranian government might do with an Iranian deterrent that is held by the government. It's what Iranian radicals might do to transfer some of this capability to other organizations that might do damage to us.
Now, this is almost exactly the argument that George Bush raised and continues to raise about Iraq, that
that they could feed nuclear materials to a terror network that would threaten the United States. Israel must fear the same thing. What are the implications of that now and in the future?
Well, first of all, let's make the comparison, because David Kaye has started us quite correctly in the right direction here. The comparison is that whereas there was thinking and belief that Iraq was going to restart its nuclear program, which proved not to be as far along as we imagined. Mm-hmm. In the Iranian case, we know the capability is present. And while in Iraq there was a lot of speculation about connections to terrorists, in the Iranian case we know those connections exist. So you're going to have a case here with a known supporter of terrorist organizations like Hezbollah and Hamas and others, plus a nuclear weapons potential that is not that far down the road. And I think that is what is so troubling about this particular case.
So what do you think when Israeli military brass sit around and contemplate Iran today then? They've been known to take action. What are they thinking as they watch this unfold?
Well, I think now you have to get down to practicalities. Iran is physically farther away than Iraq was. The Iranian facilities are more widely distributed and dispersed. Some of them are underground. The scale of an attack that would be required would be much, much greater than just knocking out one small reactor in Iraq, which in the end was not, the reactor was destroyed, but the outcome was not a permanent solution to the problem.
Right.
So I have to imagine that if we are going to be nervous as a nation about the possibility of a terrorist state, basically, and I'm sorry to be overstating my view of the Iranian government, but I just want to make the point. Acquiring nuclear weapons, you know, this takes on a somewhat different look, and matters that would be considered sort of inconceivable begin to take on more of a reality in terms of American intervention. Now, it's, as a practical matter, very, very hard to imagine how we could actually execute some kind of destruction of this program. But one has to imagine that thought is being given to this, whether it's, and I don't know how far it would go. But it's the sort of threat now which is truly much more dire than the threat of a nation simply having these weapons and brandishing them from time to time in the context of American deterrence.
Mohammad Hadi Samadi, do you imagine that officials sitting in Tehran are aware of that kind of temptation or inclination potentially on the part of the Pentagon and determined not to push their nuclear weapons program any further because they fear it might trigger that kind of armed intervention from, let's say, the United States?
Well, frankly, I suspect at this point there is no chance that the Iranians, as I see it, giving up their fuel factor capability and some of the capabilities that they are pursuing. But as I said earlier, I don't suspect that the Iranians have made the decision and will make the decision, given the fact that they realize the cost associated with it to pursue a nuclear weapons options. I mean, they're living in a very difficult neighborhood, and they have all sorts of security concerns. And I think there is an anxiety in Tehran. They see the ultimate source of threat coming from the U.S. And that's why fundamentally the bad cop, good cop division of labor between Europe and U.S. actually kind of failed, because ultimately, the U.S. was perceived in Tehran by Iranians and Iranian government to be the ultimate party in the neighborhood that is not going to believe Iran, even if Iranians 100% and 100 times sign up the additional protocols, all sort of safeguards and standards of IEA. So there is a sense there that, you know, sort of a strategic vulnerability that they feel and a strategic loneliness. And I think Washington inadvertently over the last few years have politicized this issue so much and has played this into the domestic politics of Iran that it has become very difficult for Iranians to compromise and to give up. Hmm. And in the absence of feasible, and I think operationally speaking and the rest, in the absence of a broader political framework, I don't see the possibility and feasibility of a quick resolution. And it's only the U.S. that actually can approach this from the vantage point of a political dialogue with Tehran. Europeans cannot deliver at the end of the day because they are not the source of threat as they see, as
right.
Iran sees it.
Right. David Kaye, what about that? Maybe Iran has found what it might think is a sweet spot within some reach of nuclear weapons, 12 months, as you suggest, maybe it will hover right there and not go further. Enough capability to have leverage, to have bargaining power, but not so much that it draws a kind of mandatory military strike from the U.S.
Well, this is indeed the hope of the Europeans, of course, was based that you get some stable point that would, in fact, allow the Iranians to maintain that they have not backed down on technological capability, but yet they've not proceeded far enough to worry either about a state acquisition or a terrorist acquisition. I must say, it's awfully hard to read Tehran from a distance, but it looks like, in fact, there is a faction that is not interested in stopping there, but would like to go further. One hopes that, indeed, that decision has not been made and is still the subject of internal debate in Iran. It will not be, I think, the most stable of situations. Quite frankly, I don't think the Israelis would view the neighborhood as being stable and not more dangerous and count on deterrence if the Iranians acquired nuclear weapons. I think there is a strong temptation in Israel to go ahead and remove this threat. Now, Sandy's absolutely correct. It's a militarily challenging and difficult thing for them to do, at least by themselves, and so there's a practical issue there. But I think the real point, if there is a road ahead here, is actually the point of a dialogue and discussions. You know, ever since the change of regime in Iran, the hostage-taking,
late 70s, Ayatollah.
That's right, Ayatollah Khomeini. There's been no dialogue, no discussion, no engagement between the two governments. And indeed, I agree. I think the Iranians view the Americans, they view us, as the major threat to their security. You've got to move beyond that, but that takes both parties being willing to talk. And to date, they're simply on both sides. Have been a lack of sufficient political momentum to push that dialogue ahead. I think that's the real challenge we face now. It's not the challenge of inspection as much as it is to find political arrangements that will allow something else to develop.
Leonard Spector, can you imagine what Washington might say to Iran, to Tehran, that would pull it back from its nuclear weapons development capability?
Well, first of all, the point you made about the sweet spot, that's, I think, an idea that a lot of us have had for a while, which is if Iran halts right where it is, it has what it needs. It has the potential, if it ever were to be threatened, to move the program forward, but it's far enough away from weapons now to remain in the good graces of the international community and avoid an immediate threat from us.
Just in the good graces.
Barely, but let's come back to this issue because there's an uncertainty as to what they've got. There have been findings by the IAEA that are very ambiguous, and one thing we are learning more and more, and David Kaye's experience is a case in point, is that we often don't really know what's going on in these very, very secretive situations, sometimes more than we think, sometimes less. But if the Iranians want to protect their interests right now and avoid very high tensions with us, they have to make it very clear that they are not engaged in the wrong stuff, and that's going to be difficult to do. Now, what we can offer, I mean, you know, we have had a potential for a political opening with the Iranians for a long time, lifting of sanctions and the rest. Dialogues have started. They've fallen away when the Iranians have intervened in the, you know, to try to prevent the peace process from going forward with Israel, when they have taken other measures in the region that are, you know, against our interests. So I think, you know, what we need to do is to continue to probe and see if we can find some common ground, calm them down a bit, and then see if there can be some reciprocity. I don't think this administration has been absolutely rigid. They have put out probes and sometimes made a little, had some success and then been rebuffed.
But it hasn't happened yet. We've got to take a short break. We're talking about Iran pushing for nuclear weapons. You can join the conversation. How does an Iranian nuclear threat and Islamic bomb change the strategic face of the Middle East? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Iran's push toward nuclear weapons and the strategic implications of a new emerging atomic power in the Middle East. You can join the conversation tonight. Can Washington permit Tehran to develop a nuclear weapon? Does it have the capacity to stop Tehran? And at what point could it, should it act? Is it already too late? Is the world just going to accept a new nuclear power in the Middle East? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight from Washington by Mohammad Hadi Samadi, political scientist at Tehran University, currently a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment. Also in Washington, David Kaye, weapons investigator for the Bush administration in Iraq until January of this year, a senior fellow at the Potomac Institute for Policy Studies. And from Washington by Leonard Spector, deputy director of the Monterey Institute of International Studies, Center for Nonproliferation Studies. And right now, Josh is on the line. Hi, Josh. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Just great, thanks.
Good. I have two short comments. First of all, I think that a very simple point that people sometimes forget is that if someone builds something dangerous in their country and they can bring it to our country, it becomes not just their right, but it just does become our business. That's not just a private matter in their right. And second of all, if it were a democracy, if this were someone who's elected, that would be one thing. But this is a guy who, if he does something, people have to be removed. It's not that his government or people can remove him. He's still there.
So what are you suggesting should be done, might be done, Josh?
You know what? I think we're in a similar situation where all I can say is we should handle it better than we're handling Saddam right now.
What does that mean? Are you saying U.S. forces should go into Iran? I mean, it may not be fully democratic, but we've heard Mohammad Hadi Samadi say most Iranians support the idea of an Iranian bomb.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, if we have intelligence that says that they have a nuclear or biological chemical bomb that they could deliver to another country, not even necessarily the United States, then we should be going there. Unless that leader was democratically elected and he could be removed for using such a terrible thing, then yeah, we and not just us, the United Nations, should again be involved.
Josh, we've got it. Thanks for your call. Leonard Spector, how about it? Play out the scenario. Let's say Israel should strike, or let's say the United States should strike. How do you imagine the aftermath of something like that?
Well, I think, this is a very, very challenging problem. We have what is emerging to be an extremely serious threat to this country if Iran moves ahead, because we may never know what else is going on in terms of others having access to this capability, others that Iran would help. Military options are very unappealing. We're stuck in Iran now, in Iraq with 140,000 troops. We have, the physical ability to actually do an invasion is very restricted. The challenge of taking on a country of the size of Iran is very, very daunting. And you are left with some very limited, if any, military options. But I have a feeling where we may be heading is that you begin to crank up at least some threats of this kind in a hope of perhaps intimidating Iran to abide by the rules that it has accepted of not developing nuclear weapons, of accepting the international inspections with their more elaborate controls under the agreed protocol, and perhaps accepting the deal that the Europeans have been brokering. This is a very tough one, and I think that is the most important part of this conversation. It's that the threat is really genuine and getting much worse and may get out of hand more rapidly than we are thinking about it right now.
Mohammad Hadi Samadi, how do you imagine – sorry, Leonard Spector, but Mohammad, how do you imagine Iran might respond if the United States were to begin to crank up the pressure? Colin Powell says he wants to get this before the U.N. Security Council. That can be a prelude to exactly that kind of pressure, even sanctions. How is Tehran likely to respond?
I think as for the effectiveness of the military operations, I would say it's out of the question. Even if they carry, if the U.S. or the Israelis carry out, let's assume they can, the most they can achieve is prolong the process and postpone the development of the bomb. And just about everybody in the business, I think, at least as I'm concerned, that the Iranians, even if the Islamic regime collapses today, the possibility of the next regime picking up the remains is very high. So the only game in town becomes diplomatic engagement. And I think Iranians have realized the difficulties that the U.S. is involved right now, and that the effectiveness of the sanctions are seriously doubtful. There would be some sort of sanctions, but it all appears that it will be very toothless and not really too comprehensive because of the Europeans' involvement in Iranian economic investments. So I suspect Iranians would would basically strive to tolerate the pressure that will come down from a sanctioned regime. And I think, as far as Iranian political culture is concerned, if the pressure goes beyond a point, there is a threshold beyond which the pressure doesn't work at all, mm-hmm. and actually consolidates further the hardliners in Tehran in their pursuit. And frankly, the international community is not in a position to change the equation that much radically. I think even Israelis have realized that there are tremendous difficulties with that. Therefore, I suspect that the only option that has remained is somewhat a broader diplomatic engagement with less intimidation and a better carrot, in the part of the U.S. that would encourage part of the Iranians, at least the Iranian government, to realize the cost and discourage them from pursuing that. So I suspect Iran would actually, the government would respond quickly, would it already, with the oil money, the cash flow that they have, the economy is not in the structurally disastrous situation. Mm. They can somehow manage, I think, for the short and medium term. And then it will help them to rally support around the cause even further, and it will become politically more problematic for anybody who thinks and contemplates a military strike at some point.
So I still hear a strong note of inevitability in there, but the notion of negotiating at some level is maybe the only path here. Shashi is on the line. Hi, Shashi. You're on the air.
Good evening, everyone. I think the carrot and stick approach, will lead to, I think more carrots are being thrown around than sticks, and I think it'll lead to anybody who wants carrots from the United States will make noises, get a few centrifuges, and start to try to make a nuclear bomb, and the U.S. will run and provide economic aid and all these kinds of things. So it's a quagmire that is the world is getting into in terms of proliferation, not only just because it's proliferating, it's because, people figure out that, okay, this is a way to get the U.S. bank, basically like the World Bank, the nuclear bank, to open up and come and prop their economy.
Shashi, what is the alternative? That technology is now not so rare, not so hard to get hold of.
No, exactly. I don't know what the alternative is, but I'm telling you that probably there are people sitting around thinking, hey, the U.S. doesn't pay attention to us, so why don't we get a few centrifuges, and so we'll get economic aid, we'll be on the political map.
It clearly gets people's attention, Shashi. Thank you for calling in with that. David Kay, what about it? You've been involved in this anti-proliferation efforts for a long time. Are we moving into a period where it's simply going to have to be accepted, where standards get adjusted, where more nations, including potentially dangerous nations to the United States like Iran, have these weapons, period?
Well, I think the proliferation control regime is in crisis, but let me say I do not think I'm nowhere near as pessimistic as the last caller.
Mm,
the fact of the matter is that for many states, the acquisition or attempted acquisition of nuclear weapons would be both unbelievably expensive and extraordinarily dangerous. There are a few countries that occupy a genuine sweet spot where they can do it, and it's still costly and it's still dangerous, but considering the alternatives, it's doable. North Korea is an example. And Iran, because of its oil wealth, its strategic position, the failure of the post-war intervention in Iraq, may well be in that position. But I don't think you need to overgeneralize and say the Zambias of the world are about to run out and to attempt to acquire centrifuges. The Iranians invested over 50 years a considerable amount of money in building up their technological establishment. But the simple fact of the matter is that in the case of Iran, if you search for practical situations, alternatives, they're entirely diplomatic, and it really needs to take on two fronts. We need a direct conversation with the Iranians that the real thing that scares us, and Sandy Spector laid it out better than I can, about an Iranian program is the possible transfer to terrorism, and that if they go down that route, then in fact the unthinkable may become thinkable in terms of reactions. The second is...
But let me just ask you, before you go to the second, we'll get to it, but is there a realistic path toward an Iranian guarantee that nuclear weapons capacity would not leak to terrorists, particularly given Iran and the U.S. Standoff over Israel, Iran deeply opposed to.
Well, I think there is a practical step at this stage in their technological development. It is in the capacity of the International Atomic Energy Agency, mm-hmm. if the Iranians were to allow it, to allow a full comprehensive scope inspection system, that at least at the stage they are now, one could have considerable assurance.
And more than now, when you have IAEA inspectors on site in Iran already.
Well, more than you have now, because the Iranians are still at that stage of lying about what they've done or not fully disclosing it.
Yeah.
And so we've been in this discovery mode now for 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
But it is technically possible to get some assurance that it's not leaking out. But the world needs to make very clear to the Iranians that there is a bright red line somewhere out there, and that's what really scares us.
And your second path?
The second path is, quite frankly, as in much of life, buying time is not always bad and may be the best of a set of lousy alternatives. And that is to help the Iranians recognize that most of their political goals, and particularly their security objective vis-a-vis the U.S., vis-a-vis their next-door neighbor in Iraq,
mm-hmm.
are things that can be handled at a less-than-acquisition of nuclear weapons level, and to get them engaged in thinking of what are those alternatives that would give them security. I think all three of us, Donnie, have said that we're not convinced that the Iranians have made the decision to go fully ahead to acquire weapons. They're building the technological base. We need to try to buy the time to help them understand that now is a good place to stop and find a stable point.
Mm.
It may not work. They may go ahead. But quite frankly, as in much of life, it's the pace of change that is really frightening.
Let's try one more call. Thomas is calling from Guelph, Ontario. Hi, Thomas. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think that the idea that there's a sweet spot, the first sweet spot that was discussed, where you're 12 months away from having a nuclear bomb is not realistic. It's not stable. The tendency for the countries that find themselves in that position where the world kind of thinks maybe they're developing nuclear weapons,
mm-hmm.
is proven by the historical example of North Korea and Israel, that they have more power, more leverage, and if they keep it ambiguous up until the point where they can say they actually have the bomb.
So are you saying does that mean the U.S., let's say, must treat Iran's capacity to move forward already as equivalent to a realized threat?
No, but I think that the optimism that they would be somehow negotiated into a stable sweet spot where they maintain their technology base 12 months away from a nuclear bomb, mm-hmm. is very unrealistic, because I think the tendency for their national security and for their regional prestige and national prestige and all those things tied up into that is to move forward with the bomb behind closed doors, behind the back of the world.
Thomas, we've got it, and our time is short, but thank you for the thought. Leonard Spector, what about it, the idea of keeping Iran balanced right where it is and confidently imagining through negotiation, conversation, that it will be stable and steady there and not move forward?
I'd say it's a possibility, but it would take pretty clear goodwill on the part of the Iranians and a lot of transparency. And for a while, we thought we were going to get some of that, but it does not seem to be what's happening now. I mean, they are backpedaling. They are continuing to build capacity. And the other problem is we don't quite know what's out there. In other words, the one thing we've learned over the last few years is our ability to monitor these things very closely is not good. The other thing that's happened is that we know about this AQ Khan network, the former head of the Pakistani nuclear program, mm-hmm. and how he's been dispersing all kinds of technology to Iran, to North Korea, and to Libya, including a weapons design and so forth. So I don't think we quite are going to keep our fingers precisely on the pulse of how far the Iranians have gone, and I think the caller made a fair point. But it is something at least to strive for, and then to try to cover our bets as best we can with heavy inspections. But we are, in effect, at war now with radical Islam. And to imagine that the government that represents that worldview more than any other government currently might acquire nuclear weapons is a very disturbing possibility.
Not a happy picture, but the picture we're looking at. Leonard Spector, thank you for joining us tonight. Leonard Spector, Deputy Director of the Monterey Institute of International Studies in Washington. Mohammed Hadi Samadi, thank you so much for being with us. I hope you'll join us again.
Thank you.
Mohammad Hadi Samadi, political scientist at Tehran University, and David Kaye at the Potomac Institute for Policy Studies, thank you for being with us tonight.
Happy to join you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.